So, welcome to our Christian apologetics course entitled An Unshakable Faith. So, we've been looking at the evolution and science component of this course, and in the previous session, we looked at some of the icons for evolution, and in this session, we'll look at another two of those icons, namely Archaeopteryx and bird evolution, and then also whale evolution. So, if you're following through on the notes, we're starting on page 249. So we're looking at Archaeopteryx and bird evolution. So here's a picture of a sign that you'll find outside the South Australian Museum on the North Terrace side. And it's an interesting sign. It says, effectively, tries to say, don't feed the pigeons, but it does so in an interesting way. How many people have actually seen that sign? A few? Right. Well, let's read it. It says, please don't feed the dinosaurs. What dinosaurs? Well, that's right. Pigeons, like all birds, are modern-day dinosaurs. Want proof? Look at a bird's skeleton and compare it to dinosaur fossils. You'll see a lot of similarities. Feeding the dinosaurs encourages them to harass cafe patrons, and it's bad for their health. So the information presumes that birds evolved from dinosaurs. And their proposed proof is based on similarities. This is an exercise in homology, where vague similarities are emphasised and huge differences are ignored. And such an exercise demands transitional creatures, millions of them, or at least one, to fill the imagined gap between dinosaurs and birds. And so the accepted idea amongst most evolutionists is that birds evolved from reptilian dinosaurs and that Archaeopteryx has been used as a major icon of that transition for over a century, in fact, more than 160 years now. An Archaeopteryx is an extinct bird. It's been preserved in these fossils, particularly in Germany, in amazing detail. It was something like the size of a modern bird, though I find that statement quite interesting because birds range in huge range of sizes. But here's its head in the fossil, and then it's got this curve in its neck along the backbone to its long backbone here is its tail. And then off that we've got the feet down the bottom here. And off the upper appendages with little claws on the end here, we have one wing and another wing. So early on, the Darwinists looked at it as a missing link because of supposed reptilian features such as teeth, long bony tail and claws on its wings. By the way, this pose of the arched neck and stretched out tail is typical of something that's drowned. And all seven of these major Archaeopteryx fossils were found in the same limestone quarry in Germany, a quarry long famous for its beautifully preserved fossils. And the first specimen was found in 1861, so 161 years ago from today. And it was Thomas Huxley who proposed the dinosaur to bird evolution, and he used Archaeopteryx as a major piece of evidence for its myth. And in his lectures, Huxley had his students envisage a Jurassic past when tiny dinosaurs with long hind limbs passed by degrees into ancient flightless birds. And these, via Archaeopteryx kin, into the songbirds heralding today's dawn. So in regard to these issues, we'll make the following observations. One, there is a raging controversy with no consensus. Two, Archaeopteryx is just a bird. Three, the only evidence is the assumption of evolution. Four, there is no scientific explanation for such a change. Five, what if some dinosaurs have feathers? And six, evolutionary art is mythical and deceptive. So let's have a look at those in detail. Firstly, there is a raging controversy with no consensus. Archaeopteryx has been the subject of heated controversy since its discovery. And Paul Chambers, author of History of Archaeopteryx, says, It has probably been at the centre of more bitterness and confrontation than any other single scientific object. The rancor began in 1861 and is just as vigorous today. The bitterness it engenders, if anything, is worse today. And though evolutionists generally agree that birds evolved from dinosaurs in some fashion, there are also competing theories. Some believe that birds evolved from Archaeopteryx or a similar creature. Some others that flying birds evolved from non-flying ostrich-like birds. Some others again believe that birds did not evolve directly from dinosaurs, but that both evolved from a common ancestor. And this is a very vocal band or group, includes Adam Fiducia, we'll come across later, and it's sometimes known by the acronym BAND, which means birds are not dinosaurs. And then the last group believed that birds evolved from a crocodile-like reptile. And then there are two major theories about how birds evolved, particularly flight. First, there's the tree down proposition, which says birds learn to fly first by gliding from the trees down. And second, there's the group that proposed that birds evolved powered flight from the ground up. So amongst them all, there's quite a variety of thoughts on it all, with no consensus. And secondly, Archaeopteryx is actually a bird. It's just a bird. After over a century, or in fact more than 160 years of Darwinian hype about Archaeopteryx being some sort of missing link, the view that it is simply a bird is now becoming predominant. And this is true even though Archaeopteryx continues to be paraded before the public in textbooks and museums as the missing link. Here's that same fossil, by the way, with feathers added to it by the artist. And this is an actual fossil feather of the Archaeopteryx. Consider, for example, the widely distributed publication teaching about evolution and the nature of science. Published in 1998, it featured Archaeopteryx as the preeminent example of a missing link. And a mere 4 years later, Paul Chambers concluded his history of Archaeopteryx, published in 2002, with the words, "Most now feel that Archaeopteryx is actually a type of primitive bird rather than a feathered reptile or feathered dinosaur." And Alan Fiducia, who's an evolutionist and a world authority on birds, says, "Paleontologists have tried to turn Archaeopteryx into an earthbound feathered dinosaur, but it's not. It is a bird, a perching bird, and no amount of paleo babble is going to change that." And Archaeopteryx had elliptically shaped wings made of flying feathers with avian barbule, these things that hook together, that system that ingeniously fastens the feathers together to allow for flight. Its feathers are asymmetrical in shape, meaning there are more filaments on one side of the feather or the central vein than the other, which is essential for flight. And like the curved wing of an aeroplane, the asymmetrical shape of the wings provide lift. And only flightless birds have symmetrical feathers, like an ostrich or an emu. And it had movable upper and lower jaw or mandible, unlike most reptiles, which have only a movable mandible or lower jaw. And it had a large wishbone down the centre of the chest for attachment of muscles responsible for the downstroke of the wings. The very powerful strokes would rip its chest apart if it didn't have that. And it was once thought that Archaeopteryx had solid bones like a reptile rather than thin and hollow bones like a bird, but it's now known that its bones, and these are one of its bones, are actually thin and hollow, just like a flying bird. And a CT scan of the brain case of Archaeopteryx performed in 2004, here's the picture of it, it's done obviously on a fossil, found that the brain was like that of a modern bird. Its brain was larger than that of a typical dinosaur of the same body size and had large regions for vision, hearing, and muscle coordination. And also the inner ear more closely resembles that of modern birds than the inner ear of reptiles. And these characteristics taken together suggest that Archaeopteryx had the keen sense of hearing, balance, spatial perception and coordination needed to fly, just like any other flying bird. And three, the only evidence for evolution is the assumption of evolution. Apart from the evolutionary bias and presumptions, there is zero scientific evidence that Archaeopteryx or any other proposed dino birds are missing links on the pathway toward bird evolution. What about the supposed reptile features? They no more prove that Archaeopteryx was an evolving dinosaur than a platypus's duck bill proves that it's an evolving duck. And Francis Hitching, who is an evolutionist, says every one of its supposed reptilian features can be found in various species of undoubted birds. And Jonathan Safati observes, the fact that it had teeth is irrelevant to its alleged transitional status. A number of extinct birds had teeth, while many reptiles do not. And the Archaeopteryx is no problem for the Bible believer. God made all sorts of flying creatures. There are flying insects, flying reptiles like pterosaurs, flying mammals, bats, and flying birds, and there are vast numbers of varieties of each. And fourthly, there is no scientific explanation for such a change. Evolutionists have never provided scientifically feasible evidence of how a reptile could change into a bird. The following are just some of the necessary changes. A heavy earthbound body would have to evolve into a lightweight aerodynamic one. Solid bones would have to evolve into hollow bones that are light but incredibly strong. And scales would have to evolve into complex flight feathers. Bellows-like lungs would have to evolve into the avian sac-like lungs. And a land-bound reptile brain would have to evolve into an avian brain capable of thriving in a completely different environment. And a creature that can only grunt or squeal or croak would have to evolve the ability to sing pretty songs, and very complex songs. So scales would have to evolve into complex flight feathers. A simple pigeon feather is composed of more than 1 million individual parts, made up of billions of cells perfectly organized into a marvel of design. And the flight feather is an amazingly complex system with the following three major features. A hollow stem containing air or foam, which changes its shape to give structure and strength. And a smaller shafts or barbs that angle off the stem, forming the basic feather shape. And two sets of barbules that angle off the barb to hook them all together. And Richard Dawkins claims that feathers are modified reptilian scales. And Jonathan Safari says, right. There's barely any difference to speak of, except that scales are folds in the skin, whereas feathers are complex structures with a barb, barbules and hooks that originate in totally a different way from follicles inside the skin in a manner akin to mammalian hair. Not much difference. And bellows-like lungs would have to evolve into the avian sac-like lungs. And drastic changes are needed to turn a reptile lung into a bird lung. Reptile lungs work like bellows. The air is drawn in and the stale air is then breathed out the same way it came in. In the lung, blood extracts the oxygen and releases carbon dioxide on the surface of ingrowths called septae. But the bird or birds have a complicated system of air sacs, even involving hollow bones. And this system keeps air flowing in one direction through special tubes in the lung, and the blood moves through the lung's blood vessels in the opposite direction for efficient oxygen exchange. An excellent engineering design. How would the bellows-style lungs of reptiles evolve gradually into avian lungs? Also, a creature that lives and dies in one place would have to evolve the ability to migrate long distances. The Arctic tern migrates more than 9,000 miles from the Arctic to the Antarctic. An Alaskan bar-tailed godwit that was tracked with a satellite tag flew 6,800 miles in 1 8-day flight. And the golden plover migrates from Alaska to Hawaii, unerringly finding a tiny island in the middle of the Pacific Ocean after a journey of 3,000 miles. And this amazing reptile-to-bird evolutionary process, which is blind and non-intelligent and directionless, would have to produce 24 orders of birds, from eagles to woodpeckers, to swans, to penguins, to hummingbirds. And British biologist Kenneth Pope observes, "Try to imagine the incredible numbers of oddball species necessary to bridge the gaps between any lizard and any bird. It takes a most active imagination to conjure even a hypothetical fossil record. For example, describe the anatomy of an intermediate species that transitions from cold to warm-blooded, which a reptile would have to do en route to becoming a bird. Considering the specificities and the complexities of both metabolic systems, any type of half and half would be something out of a poorly done science fiction." And the evidence that some dinosaurs had feathers is highly questionable, but what if some types of dinosaurs had feathers? Well, Ken Ham says, "What if a dinosaur fossil was found with feathers on it? Would that prove that birds evolved from dinosaurs? No. A duck has a duck bill and webbed feet, as does a platypus. But nobody believes that this proves that the platypuses evolved from ducks. And the belief that reptiles or dinosaurs evolved into birds requires reptilian scales on the way to becoming feathers, that is, transitional scales, not fully formed feathers. And a dinosaur-like fossil with feathers would just be another curious mosaic, like a platypus. And part of the pattern of similarities placed in creatures to show the hand of the one true creator God who made everything." And did dinosaurs have feathers? Well, you go to the fossil record, you find skin and scales occasionally, and they're preserved, but there's no undisputed feathers. Over here is a supposed 110 million-year-old nodosaur. It's got its armour preserved, its scales preserved. It's even got its last lunch in its stomach preserved, but no feathers. And over here is a piece of skin of an Edmontosaur from Montana, beautifully preserved. It's quite rare to preserve this, by the way. The skin is there, the scales are there, no sign of feathers. And evolutionary art is mythical and deceptive. The dino bird hypothesis has been successfully promoted by the use of mythical art. But the drawings and models of dino birds in books and museums are a great deception. This thing here is Bambi Raptor. Never existed, but it sounds cute. Even some evolutionists have protested this practice. In an open letter to the National Geographic Society, Dr. Storsolson, a Smithsonian Institute evolution scientist, has referred to the practice of adding features to dinosaurs as propaganda, hype, wishful thinking, melodramatic, nonsense, spurious, fantasia, and a hoax. And he goes on to say, "The idea of feathered dinosaurs and the theropod origin of birds is being actively promulgated by a cadre of zealous scientists acting in concert with certain editors at Nature and National Geographic, who themselves have become outspoken and highly biased proselytizers of the faith. Truth and careful scientific weighing evidence have been among the first casualties in their program, which is now fast becoming," and this is his statement, "one of the grandest scientific hoaxes of our age." And that's from an evolutionist. And Gerhard Heilmann's The Origin of Birds, published in 1926, featured a lifelike picture of Proavus, pictured there, the supposed missing link. is depicted with both scales and feathers, and is shown climbing a tree and gliding through the air like a flying squirrel. This is pure myth. There never was such a beast. There is no fossil evidence for such a creature, but it fitted Harman's tree-down proposition that dinosaurs first evolved the ability to glide before they developed powered flight. And Harman hated God and the Bible, and in spite of the mythical character, the impact of Harman's book cannot be exaggerated. Only the Lord can calculate how many people have believed or been influenced to believe in evolution and thus to disbelieve the Bible because of deceptive evolutionary art. So in summary of the evidence against the doctrine of bird evolution, we can say after years of being called a missing link, Archaeopteryx is now being treated as a true bird by evolutionists. And it is impossible to prove from the fossil record that one type of creature evolved into another type. And to change a small dinosaur into a bird would require a miracle as great as that described in Genesis chapter 1. And the artwork pertaining to bird evolution is mythical. So we'll have a look at the second icon, namely whale evolution, and we'll move through to page 257 in the notes. So another icon of evolution is the supposed evolution of the whale from a land animal. And in the first edition of On the Origin of Species, Charles Darwin speculated that the whale evolved from the bear. And today, according to the research by Brother Cloud, most popular idea is that the whale evolved from a mesonyx, a small, hairy, four-legged mammal similar to a wolf, or from a similar creature called a synonyx. Others, as you do your research, point to endorhyxes, but this is also disputed. But the most common agreed starting point is Pachycetus. They're all wolves, all wolf-type creatures. So the whale evolution chart at the Pacific Science Centre in Seattle depicts the entire whale family evolving from a little wolf-like animal. So here's all the whales over here, and here's our little wolf, whichever one it is. So except from the change from a bear to a wolf or which wolf, the story of whale evolution hasn't changed much since Darwin's day. Consider the following just-so story from National Geographic magazine. The whale's ascendancy to sovereign size apparently began 60 million years ago when a hairy, four-legged mammal, or mammals, in search of food or sanctuary, ventured into the water. As eons passed, not the same one staying in the water, of course, changes slowly occurred. Hind legs disappeared, front legs changed into flippers, hair gave way to a thick, smooth blanket of blubber, nostrils moved to the top of the head, and the tail broadened into flukes, and in the buoyant water world, the body became enormous. So it should have started once upon a time, shouldn't it? And David Cloud says, the evolutionary story from National Geographic has as much factual basis as a Hindu myth, and the reconstructions have not been scientifically honest. So evolutionists claim that the process is directionless, blind, random, and unintelligent. And yet we do see a general direction as indicated in this fictional chart on the left. So evolutionists would claim that some primordial soup, or maybe an alien or something, started the first cell, which then developed in the marine environment into a fish, into an amphibian, into a reptile, into a mammal, into apes, and finally into man. So generally life went from the sea to the land. Now, whale evolution proponents are saying that somehow evolution reversed its directionless direction and land animals now are evolving into sea animals. So we go from this land animal completely against the natural, so-called natural, direction of evolution to produce sea animals. It's interesting. So let's have a look at what the evolutionists propose here. So we've got our wolves, and we'll get to Pachycetus here. And then we go to Ambulocetus, then to Rhodocetus, Dorodon, and Bacillosaurus, and finally into the modern whales, represented by a humpback whale there. Before we look at these in more detail, we want to take the dates that the evolutionists provide and just have a look at these things for a little while. All right, so Pachycetus supposedly developed 51 to 50 million years ago, and then evolved into Ambulocetus. There's only a gap of 1 million years between Pachycetus and Ambulocetus. No time even for an evolutionist to propose any evolution. And then Ambulocetus is supposed to have evolved into Rhodocetus. Guess what? 0 million year gap. And then Rhodocetus supposed to have evolved into Dorodon. And guess what? 1.6 million years in evolutionary time, nothing. And Dorodon is supposed to have turned into Bacillosaurus. Guess what? Another 0 million year gap. So the credibility, even from the evolutionists, with a time frame that I don't agree with, but from the time frame they present, they've got serious credibility problems. And it actually gets worse, because there's a whale jawbone that was found in the Antarctic, dated it by the evolutionists as 49 million years ago. A true whale. That puts it way up here. So Pachycetus, in 1 million years, turned into a full whale. And then its ancestors started to develop. So the whale is formed here, same time as Ambulocetus, then Rhodocetus and Dorodon and Bacillosaurus. You cannot have your great-great-great-great-grandfather being born after you're born. So the credibility of this time frame is just shot to pieces by their own dating. So goodbye to whale evolution. But let's have a look at some of the creatures they propose. So let's have a look at Pachycetus. Pachycetus, one of my favourites. So this proposed missing link was discovered by Phil Gingerick in Pakistan. So he claimed, in its morphology, Pachycetus is perfectly intermediate, a missing link between earlier land mammals and later fully-fledged whales. And in 1994, he drew this illustration of Pachycetus swimming underwater like a whale, with paws that look like fins and a stumpy tail allegedly on its way to changing into a fluke that we find on whales. Well, guess what? When more bones of Pachycetus were unearthed, whale experts, evolutionary whale experts, stated in the evolutionary magazine started by Thomas Huxley way back, always given to evolution, Nature, that it was strictly a land animal. So, sorry, there's no whale evolution left. We only have 1 million between Pachycetus and a true whale, so it's all gone. This is definitely not a missing link. The new drawing of Pachycetus is a dog-like animal with a pointy snout and long tail. It is not a missing link, and it probably did not even like to go in the water. Well, let's keep going. Ambulocetus. Ambulo means walking. It's how they used to carry people on the ambulance. And cetus means whale. So this is the walking whale. It was a strange-looking 10 to 12-foot creature, up to almost 4 metres long, that lived in what is now northern Pakistan in its long-lost coastal shallow seas and brackish rivers. It is traditionally dated at 49 million years, just like the whale jawbone, and could both walk on land and swim. It possibly lived like a crocodile and may be an amphibian or a reptile rather than a mammal. And, of course, the reason why they went to a land mammal to turn into a whale was they needed a mammal. And if this thing is not a mammal, there's no point in even talking about it. And then there's Rhodocetus, which was proposed as a missing link between the land mammal and the whale. It is depicted in museums and textbooks as a creature that has some whale-like features, such as a long whalish snout, a whalish tail or fluke, and flippers, but with four legs, shorter ones at the back and longer ones at the front. And the scientist responsible for the reconstruction is Dr. Phil Gingerick of the University of Michigan. We've already heard about him. He oversaw the drawing of Rhodocetus for the university's Museum of Natural History. It depicts a slim aquatic creature with a long toothy snout, a fluke tail, flipper-like hands on its legs and feet. Well, while filming a video documentary, Dr. Carl Werner noticed a discrepancy at the university's fossil display between the drawings of Rhodocetus and the actual fossil. And so in an interview with Dr. Gingerick, Dr. Gingerick confirmed from his own mouth that the drawings are mere speculation. He said, "We don't have the tail of Rhodocetus. We don't know for certain whether it had a ball vertebrate indicating a fluke or not. So I speculated that it might have had a fluke." And Gingerick also acknowledged that the flippers were drawn without fossil evidence, and subsequent findings have confirmed that Rhodocetus did not have flippers. And yet, evolutionists are still citing Rhodocetus as evidence of the evolution of the whale. For example, Dr. Tasser Hussain, paleontologist, says on camera in that documentary by Carl Werner, "We have a complete modern whale-type structure in Rhodocetus." Not true. And further along the evolutionary journey, we find Dorodon, supposed to have lived 40 to 43 or 34 to 40 million years ago, somewhere around 40 million years, give or take, whatever. Doesn't matter to evolutionists. This 5-metre-long animal had proper flippers and tiny hind legs. It lived entirely in water and was a good swimmer. It also gave birth to young underwater, and clearly it was entirely an aquatic creature. It's not half land, half marine. And by the way, these small bones down here, which are not attached to the main skeleton, these are not vestigial legs. They are purely something around the reproductive organs to give it a bit of strength in that area. We'll find that in true whales as well. And then there's Bacillosaurus. As soon as you hear saurus, you think reptile, dinosaurs, etc. It's also used as a link in the chain of whale evolution. It was featured in the Discovery Channel series Walking with Dinosaurs, and also the National Geographic special report, Evolution of the Whale, which was published in 2001. And Bacillosaurus was a large sea creature, but it was probably a reptile, according to Kenneth Pope. And further, the evolutionary timeline is wrong. Dr. Lawrence Barnes, a whale evolution expert at the Natural History Museum in Los Angeles, notes that Bacillosaurus didn't live until after modern whales evolved. So the evolutionary chart that produced for supposed whale evolution is shot to pieces. Now, consider how miraculous it would be for a wolf or a bear or any other creature to evolve into the 13 families and 79 species of whales. From the finless porpoise measuring about 4 feet long to the blue whale measuring up to almost 100 feet. The latter weighs 160,000 pounds, the equivalent of 2,500 people, or 4,440 wolves. And its tongue is the size and weight of an African elephant. And its heart the size of a small car. And its heart pumps 2,640 gallons. When you convert that, it's about close to 10,000 litres of blood we're talking about. And a human, I'm not sure why you would, but a human could swim through the massive aorta. And the blue whale has to eat 1 million calories a day. But that's equivalent to about 1,000 banana splits. And in the main assembly today, we probably have about an average of 10 banana splits each. So you imagine eating that all in one day. You'd probably never want to see another banana split in your whole life. But that's a lot of banana splits and a lot of calories. Even for you, brother. Now, consider the problem of evolving the whale's diving ability. Bottlenose dolphins easily dive to depths of nearly 1,200 feet. And the beak whale can dive to a depth of over 1,600 feet. And the largest of the toothed whales, the sperm whale, can, with a length of about 65 feet and a weight of about 120,000 pounds, dives easily to 3,000 feet, almost a kilometre. And it can dive even further to a depth of 10,000 feet, which is about 2 miles, somewhere around 3 kilometres. In order to withstand the enormous pressures at such depths, which even at depths of about 3,000 feet are 100 times, or 100 atmospheres, 100 times what it is at sea level. And the cranial and auditory apparatus of the whale must be very specially modified, including great increased vascularisation of the ear. And the sperm whale has a huge chamber containing several hundred gallons of sperm oil, or spermaceti, which alters according to depth and temperature to permit adjustment in buoyancy. If we ever dived down, we'd be as thin as a pancake, incredibly crushed, but the whale can adjust. And before diving, this whale goes through a 10-minute breathing exercise in order to, for its muscles, its blood and its lungs to store oxygen. And its blood contains 50% more hemoglobin than human blood. And whilst humans only use 10 to 20% of their breathed air for energy, the whale can utilise 80 to 90%. And during a dive, 9% of oxygen comes from the air in its lungs, 41% comes from its blood, and 50% from its muscles and tissues. And consider also the problem of change in the pelvis. One of the principal problems for Darwinians in whale evolution is constructing a pattern of events for the whale's tail to emerge in small, naturally selected steps. The point is that the tail moves up and down, whereas in a land mammal it moves from side to side. And this may sound a relatively small difference, but anatomically it is not. It means that somehow the whale's ancestor had to get rid of its pelvis. And according to Michael Pittman, a young Cambridge University biologist who studied this problem, every downward movement of such a tail would crush the reproductive opening of the creature against the back of the pelvis, causing pain and harm. And so natural selection would work against, not for, such a change. So for the up and down action of the whales to emerge, there simultaneously had to be random genetic changes that diminished the pelvis while allowing the tail to grow larger. And apart from the stupefying long odds against such a chain of events happening by chance, Pittman has concluded that there is a further anatomical objection. At a certain point in the supposed transitionary period, the hip bone would have to be too small to support the hind legs, and yet too large to permit the musculature necessary to move the great tail of the whale. And Douglas Dewar, a fellow of the Zoological Society, says, both whales and sea cows swim by the up and down movement of the great flattened tail. Such movement is impossible in a land animal that has a pelvis. But a well-developed pelvis is essential to every land animal which uses its hind legs for walking. And I've repeatedly asked evolutionists to describe or draw the skeleton of a creature of which the pelvis and hind legs are anatomically midway between the state that prevails in whales and sea cows on the one hand and a land quadruped on the other. And no one has accepted the challenge. And of course, a fossil of such a creature has not been found. And consider the problem of the baby whale. The babies of whales are born underwater. If they were delivered in the way human babies are normally delivered, head first, they would not survive. They would drown. All whales are born tail first, and baby whales must nurse underwater. And if they had to nurse in the usual way, they would either drown or starve to death. No problems. The mammary glands of the mother whale are equipped with muscles which enable her to rapidly squirt the milk into the baby's mouth. Under such pressure, it would create a fountain above water of about 6 feet high. And her milk contains 42% fat, 12% protein, compared to human 4.4% fat and about 1% protein in the mother's milk. A baby blue whale drinks about 200 pounds of milk daily, gaining about 175 pounds. That's about 80 kilograms each day. 80 kilograms is about the size of a typical male. That's a lot of milk. And the baby's whale mouth fits snugly into the mother's body so the seawater won't get mixed with the milk. And its windpipe is elongated above the gullet so the milk cannot flow into its lungs as well. And this design had to be perfect in both the mother and the baby whale from the very first time a baby whale was born and needed to nurse underwater. And these are only a few of the problems inherent in evolving a wolf or any other land creature into a whale. Whale evolution is not science, it's a wild-eyed story, according to Brother Cloud. So in summary of the evidence against whale evolution, we can say, one, it is impossible to prove evolutionary descent from the fossil record. One can observe certain similarities of structures, but this does not prove that one type of extinct creature had any type of evolutionary connection with another. This can only be assumed, cannot be proven. It is not science. And secondly, to name an extinct creature a whale, like Pachycetus, whale, does not make it a whale. And to change a wolf-like creature into a whale would require a miracle as great as that described on day 5 of creation. Genesis 1 verse 21 states, "And God created great whales and every living creature that moveth, which the waters brought forth abundantly after their kind, and every winged fowl after his kind. And God saw that it was good." And those vestigial legs, so-called, are just a myth. So in summary of the evolutionary icons, we can say too many people have just accepted what has been dished out to them under the guise of science and been led astray. And so the warnings of Scripture that don't change, they don't evolve, they still apply today. 1 Timothy 6, verse 20, avoiding profane and vain babblings and oppositions of science, falsely so-called. And 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 21, prove all things, hold fast that which is good. Let's pray. Our Father, we do thank you that thy word is truth. It's unchanging and it's been given to us so that we might know the truth and might continue in it, for in so doing we shall know the truth and the truth shall make us free. We thank you and praise you in Jesus' precious name. Amen.